You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Paul Auster, the author most recently of Leviathan, that's been published by Viking, author as well of the New York Trilogy, The Music of Chance, Moon Palace, In the Country of Last Things, as well as of a newly expanded book of essays called The Art of Hunger, being brought out soon by Sun and Moon Press. I thought I'd begin by asking what the first book by Beckett was that you read.
The first book I read by Beckett, if I'm not mistaken, was Molloy, the first book of his trilogy. And I think it's pretty safe to say that it changed my thinking about what writing could be. It had an enormous impact. I think I was 18 years old at the time.
For me, it was Watt.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, something does alter about reading itself when you read the same words repeated in different variations across the page. You feel the words massaging your eyes in a way that you wouldn't under other more normal circumstances, perhaps outside Gertrude Stein. And so, you know, it was a quest for books that would make me feel that way.
Well, Watt is filled with that kind of material. Page after page of so-and-so turned to so-and-so, who turned to so-and-so, back and forth, back and forth. I think that's one of the funniest books of the 20th century
so
in the English
I,
language.
Yeah.
And I still know passages of Watt by heart because...
Which ones? I do too.
Well,
I'm curious.
There's one of the funniest paragraphs I can think of is, I can't remember where in the book, it goes something like this. Watt conceived for Mr. Graves a feeling little short of liking. In particular, Watt liked Mr. Graves' way of speaking. Turd and fart, he said, for third and fourth. Watt liked these venerable Saxon words. And when, sitting on the sunny stoop, with a twinkle in his old blue eye, Mr. Graves looked up and said, in mock self-deprecation, "'Tis only me turd or fart," then Watt felt that perhaps he was prostituting himself to some purpose.
Well, that's wonderful. You know, once I was sitting with Hugh Kenner, and Kenner had said, you know, I don't think Beckett has ever mentioned Laurel and Hardy by name in any fiction. And I said, yes, he does. In what? He said, he does? I felt very happy to be up on Kenner. But in the addenda, Watt runs into a gardener who remembers him from childhood and says of him, you used to wet your pants. And Watt says, I wets them still. And he shows him a bush called the Hardy Laurel.
That's it, yes.
And at night in his journal, Watt writes, made merry with the Hardy Laurel. To what extent, or to any extent, would you say your own style has been influenced by Beckett's? I know the content to some extent, but the writing style seems fairly aloof.
I think, in the end, my style has very little to do with Beckett's. And in fact, I think my books have very little to do with Beckett's books. It was just a moment in my life, and a long moment, before I actually started writing fiction myself, when I felt that he had, in some way, reinvented the possibility of narrative. If you look at Joyce, his mentor, who had taken what you would call, I suppose, the realistic novel to its very end, it's sort of the logical conclusion of what's possible from realism. And then you look at Proust, who took another direction and also wrote the great Rocky Mountain range of realistic fiction that no one really can get higher than. Beckett, of course, was the first man in English to write about Proust, and he knew Joyce. He came out of both of them. And I think he just understood that that kind of modernism was finished, and that if you proposed to write prose fiction anymore, you had to start all over again. And I think he performed an act of radical surgery on what the novel can be. And that's what interests me. The fact that his books go in a certain line and speak about certain things is less important than the formal breakthrough. And I think that's what marked me. Finally, I think my works are filled with a lot more hope than Beckett's. And they're much more grounded in some kind of everyday existence. But I think it was the mental and artistic courage on his part that had the greatest influence on me.
I was wondering, you know, when I had read that Kafka had admired Robert Falzer, I immediately had to read Jakob van Gunten, a novel about a young man who realizes that in order to live, he's going to learn how to be subservient. And so he enters a school for butlers, the Benjamenta Institute. But Kafka, you know, is another one of those writers who seems to have effected a radical break with everything before him. So one's relieved to find an acknowledged secret precursor. Who are the other writers for you?
The other writers for me, well, Kafka is one of them, certainly had an enormous impact on my thinking about what fiction can be. But I would say the single most important reading experience I ever had was when I was 15 years old and read Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky, and it was at that moment that I understood that I wanted to be a writer. Nothing had ever affected me so much as that book. And I said to myself, if this is what a novel can be, then I want to do it. I had no idea what I was going to say. I just understood that this was the rest of my life was going to be writing. In addition to Dostoevsky, Americans, Hawthorne and Melville have always been important. Poe, I read starting from the age of about 10 or 11. Thoreau, a little later, is somebody I keep going back to. And then, surprisingly enough, Dickens, who I think is probably, after Shakespeare, the greatest writer we have in the English language, kind of endless cauldron of inventiveness and linguistic play and daring, I think. He's willing to try anything. And he remains a source of great inspiration to me, Dickens. And Kafka, too, you know, was influenced by Dickens.
Oh, sure, and yeah. Especially in America, I think, is where he acknowledged the influence. I'm always surprised now because what happens to Dickens had been my favorite boyhood writer. And now, although I still love the prose and the characters and their ways of speaking, I find myself so impatient with the ways in which the novels are put together that I don't read more than 40 or 50 pages at once. It's sort of, it could just be the effect of modernism on me, is that I have to break down Our Mutual Friend into modernist fragments and then read it that way.
But it's funny you mentioned that particular book, because I do feel that that is his greatest work. It's the last finished book. And it explores so many contemporary subjects, fragmentation, money, the law, in ways that are, I think, very, very contemporary still. And it's interesting. My wife, who's also a novelist, wrote her dissertation at Columbia on that particular book, Our Mutual Friend. We talked about it for years at home.
Well, you know, we're talking about it still. It's a great book, you know. And has perhaps the most damaged people in it prior to 20th century fiction that one's likely to encounter. In fact, I think that the, you know, what with the spontaneous combustions and the strange habits of noses to sprout protuberances and an interest in being crippled, I think Dickens certainly is pre-Beckett, you know.
Absolutely. Mr. Venus, the articulator of bones. It's a wonderful character. Jenny Wren, the storyteller. It's all very much alive still.
Now, I wondered, you know, your breakthrough, at least to, you know, a public audience, was with the New York trilogy that are, at least to my mind, combinations of Knute Hampson, among others, with detective writers. And I had, I'm afraid to say, a snobbishness, maybe because of the Beckett-Kafka thing, about anything imported to make narrative more lively. I liked it cadaverous, and I liked it inert. How did you feel those things consorted with one another, the forward propulsion of detective fiction with the sort of philosophical paralysis of the other.
Well, there is something gripping about a good detective novel. There's no question about it, because it is quintessential narrative. It's the thing that moves ahead. It's the work in which everything is important. Nothing can be neglected. It's somehow a metaphor for all fiction, in a sense. I am not particularly interested in the form, and I do hope I used it to achieve other ends altogether. Mm-hmm. And I think the only reason why the books developed as they did was because of this strange experience I went through. Maybe you've heard about this. I don't know. But I was home in my room one day. It was, I think, 1980, working on The Invention of Solitude, a previous book, when the phone rang. And I picked up, and the person on the other end said, "Is this the Pinkerton Agency?" I said, "You know, it's a famous private detective agency." "No," I said, "you have the wrong number," and I hung up, forgot all about it. The next day, the phone rang again. "Is this the Pinkerton Agency?" Again, I said no and hung up. But that second time, after hanging up, I said, "How silly of me. Why didn't I say yes? It would have been very interesting just to play along with this wrong number for a while." And I waited and waited for the phone to ring again, and it never did. And that really was the origin of City of Glass, the first book in the trilogy. One thing led to another. The idea of implicating myself in the story, you see, became important. And the idea of detectives who were not detectives. And I wanted to remain faithful to that original experience. And other than that, I never would have thought about writing anything that resembled a detective novel until that experience.
Well, it's interesting because I guess for me, you're 5 years older than I. I came to consciousness in the 60s, and so, you know, for me, the resources of detective novels had already been well appropriated by the avant-garde, mm-hmm. In one direction by Robbe-Grier, in another direction by Borges, and then in embarrassing directions, in directions I had no care for, no interest in, by Jerome Charon. Mm-hmm. And so it felt like such retilled ground, you know, that I began to wonder, well, why would Paul Auster, and you seem to me to be one of the most well-informed in terms of the avant-garde of literature, be interested in pursuing this particular trek yet again?
Just because, as I said, the inspiration for the story was given to me in that kind of context. And I wouldn't want to make any more of the use of the genre than that. Anybody interested in detective novels would be very disappointed by these books, and they really have nothing to do with them. Talking about Beckett, Waiting for Godot resembles a vaudeville music hall routine, mm-hmm. but he's taking it somewhere else. And I hope I used those references to the genre to explore other questions altogether.
Oh, isn't that interesting, Paul? Because I would say, you know, this is probably just me and my perversity, that people who love detective stories truly would probably very much like these books. Fake lovers of detective stories want to know who did it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that that real lovers of the story love the gestures of the narrative, that is to say, the hook which asks you at the beginning of City of Glass to identify yourself, yes, I am the detective of the Paul Auster Agency, is a quintessential detective story hook, and I think loved by those readers. And I think, maybe I'm crazy, but I think that one of the reasons why Beckett is not a writer who is rejected by all and sundry is that people respond to the music hall routines and the baggy pants comedians. They're not, they draw in, they are the hook.
Sure, there's no question that there's a charm to all of these forms that we know so well. and to see them used in a different context. But I think the readers you're talking about are the sophisticates, rather than the run of the mill people who eat up these detective novels.
Oh, sure.
It's sort of the happy few, I think you're referring to. I got some very angry letters from people who had read that book, when it was published. People throwing it across the room in disgust. And these, I assumed, were the real partisans of detective fiction.
Mm-hmm. When you spend years reading a writer, and it's often an accident. You read one book, and then you discover that there's another book, and mm-hmm. so you read that too. And then you've invested that, and so you read the third, and now you're looking forward to the fourth, and the fifth, sixth, the seventh come. And you start to have thoughts about the writer that are independent of the writer and his work. What I found myself thinking of you, and I suspect it's not something you think of yourself, is that the new thing you brought to the kind of novel you write, which I suspect doesn't really have a name. Some people would call it metafictional. Some people would call it postmodernist. But I thought that the thing that fascinates me was that it seems second generation, that there would be a whole arsenal of appropriative techniques that could be appropriated not just from, say, detective fiction on the one hand, but appropriated as well from Kafka, Beckett, Hamsun et al., and that the invention of solitude was an investigation of, the condition of being a son,
mm-hmm.
what it's like to not know the father, and that the subsequent books, in a way, have been investigations and attacks on rivalries with, not to be gloom about it, literary fathers. That there's a kind of comedy of inheritance that seems to go on here.
It's very interesting. As you say, I've never thought of my work in those terms. The music of chance, I suppose it's most overt there. There is the question of an inheritance that Nash gets at the beginning of the book. But I think in that particular case, well, of course, in Moon Palace, too, I'm thinking there is a bag of money that's given to Fogg.
But in addition, in the New York novels, that the character should again and again end up almost driven, I think, comically, into the Knute Hamsun position of someone without food, who's wandering the city, who's eating out of dumpsters, who's living in a solitary room, that this is necessary condition from which fiction starts and becomes necessary as a result of the history of the fiction that precedes it seems interesting to me, amusing.
Yeah, it is interesting. There's no question that I did my best to digest all these writers, that they are part of my bloodstream now. At the same time, I was living in very bad circumstances for a long time. I really was broke all through my 20s and struggling to keep things together and struggling to write. Suddenly, out of nowhere, when I was 31 years old, my father died, which is the subject of The Invention of Solitude, and I inherited some money after his death. It wasn't a lot of money, but it was enough money to take some of the pressure off me, the day-to-day pressure. And that money actually gave me the time and the freedom to start writing the novels I had wanted to do. And it seems like such a perverse equation, something so sinister, that it actually took my father's death to liberate me from my own troubles and allow me to become the writer I had always dreamed of becoming. It's frightening. And I think I'm exploring some of these very personal questions in some of the more recent novels.
I'm talking to Paul Auster, the author most recently of Leviathan, published by Viking. I wondered, Leviathan did seem, in its alteration of actual and fictional detail, to be a return to something started in the invention of solitude. What's become your interest in biography, the use of biography in fiction?
I would say that it's crucial. And I think just about all my books have been generated by some kind of reflection about biography. How do you tell the story of someone's life? What do we know about other people? What kind of evidence is useful? And it's a question, I think, that is at the heart of all writing, because all fiction is about people. It's about characters. And if you realize in your own life that you really don't know much about anybody, it raises troubling questions about how to proceed in telling a story in written words. I mean, we're all surrounded by friends. We all have people we care about. And yet, friendship is something very ambiguous, because the people we care about most are often people we don't know anything about. And there are secrets. There are things hidden from us. Lies are told, evasions and deceptions that nevertheless exist, and we can maintain close friendships, even love people, care about them to the death. That's what Leviathan explores, I think. What do we know about the people we care about? How do we know it? What's true? What's not true?
Well, it's interesting, because on the way here, I was saying to a friend of mine that the thing that I liked most about the book, what it was, its evocation, particularly of literary friendships, the kind of friendships that form of the mind and spirit, and that as a result almost don't require any particular knowledge of another person, shared agendas are enough. But I am surprised to hear you say that fiction is, after all, about people, because many novelists would not agree. They would say that fiction, regrettably, has to use the personality as a draw, but that fiction has more formal, more difficult goals. And I would have thought you would, too, so I'm curious here.
I mean, I don't see how you could write a story in which you don't have human characters. We were talking about the question of biography. I suppose you could write a book about a building or a stone or a blade of grass, but I don't think that would interest me very much.
There's another kind of attitude, which is that people, or ostensibly people, or things called characters, are the tools by which the character, by which the author constructs his formal design. But you're suggesting something more, the care about people thing. And
well,
I don't know.
It's not even that. It's simply that books, all the books I've ever written, have begun with a person, with some character who springs out of my brain and suddenly encounters me somewhere in some dark corner. It's the sound of a voice. It's the way somebody moves. And in every case, every book has somehow developed around this human encounter. I am surprised and even shocked by the tonal differences from one book to another, the variations in prose and tone more than anything else. And I understood finally, after having written a number of novels, is that the language, the references, the syntax even of every book is determined by the central character or narrator, and each one is different. And as a writer, I am in some sense sitting there impersonating somebody else. Each one of these people is a part of me, undoubtedly, but each one is distinct, separate, different. Anna Bloom's prose is not like Peter Aaron's prose, which is not like the way Nash thinks, and it's certainly not the way Fogg expresses himself. Each one is really quite separate.
A final question of Paul Auster, the author most recently of Leviathan. Recently, I was reading a novel that used the word tenderness and then went on to say, a funny word, but I am interested in it. And it seemed as if, in a way, the invention of solitude and all these books since have an undertow of tenderness about them that doesn't exactly reach the surface, but has something to do with their diligence, the diligence of narrative pursuit. And I wondered if you would talk about tenderness.
Tenderness. I don't know if I've ever used that word in any book. But I think tenderness has to do with compassion. Tenderness has to do with trying to put yourself in the skin of another person. And I think in some sense, all my books are about that. The idea that I'm some cold, calculating gamesman, which is something I hear pretty often about my work, always surprises me. Because every book that I write has come out of great emotional turmoil and is all about basically feeling of one sort or another. It's not to say ideas don't exist in the books. There isn't a structure. But it's the sadness and humor and poignancy of being a human being, existing in your own skin for a number of years on this crazy planet, understanding very little of what happens to us. This is what the books are about. So, yeah, tenderness. I would vote for that word.
Well, you see, it's funny because when I listen to, for instance, the music of Satie, no matter how formal or those phrases as in Vexations that he has the pianist repeat for at least 48 hours, there is, at least to my mind, a virtue in saying exactly what you mean and not another thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that in the absence of decoration, or in Satie, a gesture toward decoration, but which does not include decorativeness. There's a kind of, I would say, you know, tenderness. It's aligned, as many people don't think, to loneliness. And, you know, it is something like, as you say, an abstract feeling of empathy for other people and things around you. It may not include an experience of those things, but it is designed to gesture toward the willingness or the understanding that others have these experiences.
Yes, but you see, this is the secret power of all fiction, is that you open up a book and you begin to read, and you are encountering in a way that is not possible in any other place to inhabit the thoughts, to go inside the head of another person. And the solidarity of consciousness that this can establish is an extraordinary and irreplaceable thing. That's why I think books are never going to stop being written and stop being read. No other art form can do what they do.
I've been talking to Paul Auster, the author of Leviathan, published recently by Viking. Thank you for being with us today, Paul.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Mr. Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse. Wow.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.